from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. In this hour of Forum, as the International Asian American Film Festival gets underway in San Francisco, we'll talk about the importance of racial and ethnic film festivals for young filmmakers. Is it segregating their work or exposing it to a larger audience? Is it communities talking to themselves or reaching out to explain their experiences to others? Our guests include the Asian Film Festival's past and current executive directors and two local directors with works in this year's festival. The present and future of Asian American filmmaking. That's our topic this hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. Well, if you enjoy independent films by culturally diverse filmmakers, San Francisco is about as good a place to be as any. We've got festivals representing Latino, Arab American, Jewish, lesbian, gay, and African American filmmakers. And the 27th San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival opened yesterday, and it runs through March 22nd. And so this hour, we're joined by several people involved in various aspects of this and past Asian American film festivals. Joining us are Chi-Wei Yong, the festival's current director. Good to have you.
Thanks for being.
Also here, Corey Tong, an independent film producer and writer who directed the festival in the 90s, Corey, right?
Absolutely.
Back in the day. And Jennifer Pong, writer who's making her directing debut with the film Half-Life, which is being screened at the festival. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
And also H.P. Mendoza. He was the writer, composer, and an actor in the surprise hit Colma, the musical. And you're making your directorial debut in
this festival
as well with the film Fruit Fly. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin with you, Chi-Wei, if I can. Give us a sense of the range of films in this year's festival.
Sure. Well, you know, the Asian American Film Festival shows about 108 films over the course of its 11 days. And these range from short films, experimental pieces, music videos, all the way to, you know, feature narrative films and documentaries. It's primarily American independent films, films made in the United States, films that are coming from Sundance, like Jennifer's film is. We also show a lot of international cinema, too, films from Asia, from Thailand, from, you know, India, from China and Hong Kong as well. So it's a pretty broad, diverse range of films.
And of course, just the word Asian is diverse itself. I mean, there is a huge diversity within the Asian community. How does that get distributed among the films, would you say?
It's fairly broad. You know, I think that's the interesting thing about this idea of what Asian America is. You know, in a lot of ways, it's defined by its undefinability. There's so many different ethnic groups and so many different communities that are involved under that umbrella. And, you know, we really try to, on one hand, show the best films we can. On the other hand, we also want to show a broad range of what this community encompasses, too.
And how does that tension get resolved when you're deciding which films? I mean, there are other films you'd like to show, but for other considerations, maybe you don't.
Absolutely. You know, each year there are different kind of sub-themes. You know, this year we have a strong focus on multiracial Asian American films, you know, films that are looking at that experience. And for that reason, you know, we were really privileging those over some others. Other years we also have a lot of Japanese and Japanese American films this year, too. Those are some of the larger themes that are going through the festival.
Well, and Jennifer and HP, both of your films, I guess it's fair to say, have racial diversity within them. How is that living in the Bay Area, HP? I mean, is that an important value, I assume, to you? And how do you bring that to your films, and how does that inform what you do?
I think just living in the Bay Area informs that. I seriously just hold casting calls and they just kind of show up.
And how, of course, with the success of Colma, which did that, and I assume that surprised you to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was really surprising. I think it's different now, though, because now we're working with the Center for Asian American Media. And with Colma, we just said, oh, yeah, we're making a musical. We didn't even put it out there as, oh, this Asian American film. They just saw us as Asian Americans. This time they saw this as, oh, well, you know, we're Asian American. Maybe we should audition.
And so it's been easier to find people that you wanted to cast?
It was. I had specific people in mind this time around because I was writing Fruit Fly during the shooting of Colma. But it was also easier to find everybody else going through the Center for Asian American Media. A lot of CAM staff we actually cast.
When you have success with a film like that, small film nonetheless, but still got a lot of play and was in film in theaters and got a lot of media, that helps launch your career, but there's still a lot of barriers for a filmmaker like yourself, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, this is a step forward, but it's that we this is being the next film after Colma actually created some barriers. I think during Colma, we were just a bunch of punk kids with a camera, and there was a lot of goodwill going our way. This time, they're like, hey, yeah, so you want to use this location? Hey, you guys are the Colma guys, huh? Yeah, you guys must be rich now. Yeah, we're going to charge you this much money so you can shoot 10 seconds in our filthy little restaurant. And we're like, no. So we just like create a restaurant somewhere else.
Yeah, I noticed there were several scenes in, I think, Muni and Bart, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
How were they to work with?
we actually got stopped shooting on Bart.
Did you not have a permit?
Well, we did, but you know, just you see a bunch of kids running around with a camera, and you know, what do you do? And of course, they don't know what they want to say. So when they do apologize, all they say is, "Hey, I hope you understand. You know, I mean, with Homeland Security, you guys could be a bunch of terrorists. So I had to stop you." And I'm like, "Well, okay, why? A bunch of Asians with cameras? Why? What's a big deal?"
Well, let me go back and ask you to give us a little synopsis of Fruit Fly. A Filipina girl, Bethesda, comes mm-hmm. out to San Francisco and moves in a flat that looks like the Castro. I think it is the Castro.
The Mission, actually. Yeah.
The Mission. Okay, mm-hmm. and take it from there. What's she looking for when she comes out here?
She doesn't know what she's looking for. Basically, she's been doing the same performance piece for years, and her performance art's based on her trying to find her biological parents. And when she finally gives up on the notion that she might find her mother, she just decides, you know what, I'm going to take my art somewhere else. And she goes to San Francisco and moves into this artist's commune and decides, I'm going to take it easy and just do my show. And in the process of just taking it easy, she finds a photograph of her mother in San Francisco in front of the Golden Gate Bridge. And she says, and that just starts this spiral and says, okay, well, now maybe I should make this art piece about this. Maybe me trying to find my mother in San Francisco is my art. And she tries to find her mother, and that's what the movie's about. Oh, and in the process, she finds out that she's a fag hag.
Yeah, and there's a circle of straight women, including herself, who hang out with gay men, not completely unusual in San Francisco. There's actually a song in the musical that in the movie that I want to play for folks. It's called
"We Are the Hag."
We Are the Hag. Let's listen to it.
We are the hag. We'll carry through our plan, then lose them to a man.
H.P. Mendoza, that is from Fruit Fly, by the way. The phrase fag hag is a pejorative in some places. Is that a theme that you wrestled with at all, or are you trying to, you know, kind of reclaim it in a way or make it specific to the Asian American community in a way that's different from how it's known elsewhere?
There's a specific Asian theme I have, but as far as reclamation goes, it's not for me to reclaim, you know, even though people like me probably invented it or people, you know, of my, you know, gay men, that's what I mean.
Your persuasion.
Of my persuasion, thank you. My orientation, that type. It's different though when it comes to Asian women, because I feel like sometimes in the gay community, I mean, let's face it, in San Francisco, you know, we do try to push diversity and we try to, you know, beat stereotypes. But, you know, Castro's a gay white male town, you know, and a lot of times you go there and Asian women are exoticized and Asian men are emasculated. Sometimes I think Asian women are even more exoticized in the gay community than in the straight world. And, you know, during the Colma Festival run, you know, L.A. Renegan, you know, the female lead in Colma and the lead in Fruit Fly, we would go from gay festival to Asian festival to gay festival and all these different parties. And everyone automatically assumed that she was my fag hag. And on top of that, for some reason, 5 times out of 10, people would say, oh, my God, you remind me of Margaret Cho. And we'd look at each other like, why? You look nothing like her. You don't talk like her. You're actually not even saying anything. But Margaret Cho, I guess, is the only Asian icon in the gay community.
Yeah. And Jennifer, your film also, although it's totally different in terms of the tone of it, there's also that element of a straight woman having a crush on a gay man who's inaccessible. What was your thinking in having that as an element in Half-Life?
This is interesting. Perhaps, you know, I think maybe growing up as an Asian American female in California, I guess there's a sense that it's a little bit of a struggle. You're always looking for a community or a group of friends to fit in with, and maybe what we all have in common as Asian American females is a sense that maybe we find acceptance in about who we are, or what we look like from gay males the most. Maybe that's what's going on.
What do you mean by that?
I think there's, this is really quite an interesting subject matter that I didn't even expect to talk about, but Asian American females are usually looking at the beauty standards that the mainstream projects upon us when you're growing up. And so you're always usually looking at, okay, well, am I going to be as hot as Britney Spears? Am I going to be ever seen as the next, I don't know, Angelina Jolie? And I think you get the validation probably quickest from maybe gay men.
In their sense of what's beautiful.
Yeah, probably.
Let me ask you, Corey Tong, you did work with the festival a while ago, and you're still very active in film. What changes do you see in the sort of sensibility of a festival like the Asian American Film Festival here?
Well, I think that there will always be film festivals, because the festivals really, really fulfill a lot of different layers, a lot of different things for different audiences, because for some people it's a chance to see films that they will never see on a big screen in, let's say, mainstream distribution. Or they might, see it might be some press that is really, accessible, that a festival like this would provide for audiences, for readers, visibility that maybe there are it's a great way to promote a film that is also about to be released. There are different sub-communities within the larger, both Asian and not necessarily Asian communities that really are just really exploding. I mean, the audiences have increased, the diversity of audiences, and I think we'd find that in, Frameline, Lesbian Gay Film Festival as well, the Latino Film Festival, there, the Arab Film Festival, there are a lot of the Third Eye, there's so many different kinds of people who come from all different generations and ethnic cultural groups, and it's fantastic to see the mix. And that is something that I've noticed over the last 10, 15 years working in the film industry and in the exhibition festival world.
And do you think that has an impact on the directors and the kinds of films they're trying to make?
I think it's a reflection of, it's a two-way street. I think filmmakers are reflecting what's going on, or perhaps even imagining what might happen in a few years, as well as I think audiences are reacting to, they're seeing themselves on screen a lot more, their own stories, their lives, their intimate inside what happens in their homes. And I think it's a real two-way reflection, not just two ways. It's a multiple reflection.
And Chi-Wei Yang, is there a way in which within a festival like this that you can air issues and controversies that are sort of within the family, so to speak, that you wouldn't in front of a broader audience? Although I realize that the audience is getting more diverse.
Yeah, what's interesting about this festival is that a lot of these films are very personal. It's a festival mainly of independent films. These are filmmakers who are not making works necessarily as calling cards in Hollywood, but they're making very personal visions. And for that reason, they're all quite, intimate, and they are dealing with subjects that are very close to people's hearts. And a film like Children of Invention, which is premiering at the festival, it just had its premiere at the Sundance Film Festival. It's coming here, made by a young filmmaker named Zee Chun. is about two young children who are abandoned by their parents and need to start to fend for themselves. And I think it's based upon his real experiences. And he's able to kind of deal with those things through the film medium. On the other hand, there are, one film that I do want to point out is one called Diamond Head, which is an archival film that we're presenting this year. And it's, in a way, it's looking at the inside from a very different perspective. You know, it's a film that wouldn't be categorized as an Asian American film by any stretch of the imagination. It's made in 1963. It stars Charlton Heston. It's set in Hawaii. But it's about racial miscegenation. It's about multiracial Asian Americans, about a changing time in, you know, the racial demographics in the U.S., and about the Hapa community and about the origins of that. And it really speaks to a lot of what's happening today from about 40 years ago.
What are your thoughts about that, HP, that the personalizing, making a movie almost not for yourself exactly, but to really work through or highlight some very personal experiences? Is that a theme that works for you that you think is true as you approach your art as well?
I do think it works. And I think for a lot of artists, they actually attack it from that standpoint, from the get-go. And for me, I don't think I do. Usually I have this story that I think would just be cool. That would be so cool. And what I do is I whenever there's an experience that just kind of sticks in my head, whether it be me talking to you right now and it just kind of strikes me as funny or really interesting, I just kind of log it. I only have my opinion, and my opinion is formed by my own beliefs. And Fruit Fly, I really just wanted to make a musical that was about an Asian fag hag. And it just kind of blossomed into this story in which I realized I was kind of writing about myself, and I was writing about L.A. Rennegan. And I thank Cam for giving me auteurship in that respect, because this might be the last time I get to be doing anything this personal.
Are you a fag hag in a gay man's body?
Oh, yeah, what is that? I don't know. What would that be? What do you call a fag hag who's actually a fag?
We'll put that to our listeners.
Can I say that on the air, by the way?
I think you just did. is there a way in which, though, that very the making something so personal limits its exposure or its audience, or is that just not a concern?
I think there's the perception that is the case. I think that the more personal films are, the more universal they are in a lot of ways. There is a perception that somehow Asian American stories are not relatable to broader audiences. And I think that's a misperception. I think all the films in here, anyone could really get a lot out of. And certainly you have a lot of, you know, folks who are Asian American or of color watching films about white characters and identify completely with them. You know, and so that kind of I think it's a myth that you cannot look at a person of another race and identify with them. And that's something that the festival really wants to do, is to be able to say, listen, you know, these are great films. They are about a specific person or specific community, but it's quite relatable to anyone else who sees them.
That's Chi-Wei Yong. He's the director of the Asian American International Film Festival. It's playing currently in San Francisco. Also with us this hour, Corey Tong, an independent film producer and writer and past director of the festival. Jennifer Pong, who has a film in this year's festival called Half-Life, and making her directing debut, and also H.P. Mendoza, who directs the new film Fruit Fly, another musical on the heels of Colma, the musical. And if you'd like to join our conversation here on Forum, the number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org. Again, that's forum@kqed.org. I want to ask you guys about the technology and how that's changing both filmmaking and the way in which we download and watch film. YouTube, for example, is such an explosive medium right now. Corey Tong, what are your thoughts about how that's affecting people in your industry?
I think there are a lot more platforms of distribution. At the same time, I think there's a lot more, let's say, stuff to weed through in order to look at what might really resonate or interest someone. So I think along with the many, many platforms of, you know, downloadable stuff online, you know, streaming, theaters, home video, what have you, cable channels, the whole works, there is so much stuff out there. And people, individuals, and it's wonderful that people are able to, let's say, user-generated stuff, films, you know, professionally made, they're all over the place in so many different formats, and you can, you know, download things on your phone. I think that it's a matter of weeding. Who's programming this stuff? Who's editing? Who's providing the platforms? And who is controlling that also? I think it's really a complex industry now, in terms of also how people can make a living from it on the filmmaker side, in terms of who is seeing it, how you get an audience out of it, and it's just very endless possibilities as well as complex.
Does it devalue the medium, do you think?
I don't think it devalues, but I just think it takes a lot of enough interest from a viewer to really sort through all of the stuff and all of the options in order to find what might resonate. I mean, I think there will always be theatrical screenings, big screen, because I think it's a tendency for people in the world to want to be together with other people, to form in public spaces, I mean, gather in public spaces and to talk about it afterwards. I think there's also the privacy of one's home or online. You can watch porn for days. You can watch, you can be at home without leaving for days and watch, you know, 500 films or shorts or whatever you want, YouTube videos, things that people have uploaded. So I think it's there will always, it's just increasing the number of platforms. And I think it makes it, their choices are there, but it also creates, I think, overload for many people.
Chi-Wei Yang, what about you? Do you have a sense that you're competing now with a different sort of platform than you were? It's not just people going to the theater, but they have other options.
They do. And I think what's interesting about this is that, as Corey was saying, that there's a lot more things for people to see, but we're asking people to know what they want to see because they need to seek it out. And in a way, the role of the film festival is to sort through that, to program and say, this is what you should be looking at because these are some of the really interesting things. And if you go onto YouTube, it's a wild wilderness. There's so much on there that there's times when I don't even know how to deal with it because there's just too much content there.
And it never goes away, right? I mean,
it's always up there, yeah.
I mean, it's accumulating.
It's always growing. And so I think that, you know, certainly it's getting the most cost prohibitive thing about filmmaking distribution is doing theatrical, getting your films into movie theaters. And in a lot of ways, a lot of filmmakers are beginning to look beyond that. You know, I think it's still something to aspire to. But in a lot of ways, if you have a film available on demand, you can actually reach a lot more people, have a lot more people see your film than if you release it in movie theaters.
And are most of the films in the festival, will they ultimately be available, say, on Netflix?
I would say quite a few. You know, a lot of the films in the festival are short films, and which are still hard to access. Even if they're on the internet, they're of actually pretty poor quality, and it's not very pleasurable to watch them there. Quite a few will be on Netflix. Some will be released theatrically. And sadly, a lot actually will sort of disappear. And a lot of, that's changing, but for a lot of films, festivals are really still the only place to see them.
Yeah. Corey, do you find that the challenges that you face as a filmmaker, have they changed in the past 5-10 years?
They have, because the number of films on a mainstream distribution circuit, at least in this country and in the world, have decreased. There's a lot more content and many more films that have been created, shorts, TV format, and feature-length films, documentaries, the whole works. And so it is a challenge in trying to take one's film from all the way to theatrical distribution down the all through the roots and going, you know, let's say onto digital, you know, being available digitally online, and everything in between there, Netflix, you know, home distribution, DVD, TV, all over the world.
All right. We are going to continue our conversation about the Asian American Film Festival and the state of Asian American film in the second half of our program. If you'd like to join us, maybe get tips for the festival from these folks, what should you go see? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org. And again, the phone number, 866-733-6786. Stay with us. And we continue with our conversation here on Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Dave Iverson. And this hour, we're talking about the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival, which is underway. Joining us, Chi-Wei Yang, the festival's director. Also, Jennifer Pong, who has a film in the festival called Half-Life. H.P. Mendoza, a director, composer, and actor in the hit Colma the Musical, and his new film is called Fruit Fly. We'll be talking with him and Jennifer, or rather Corey Tong, who's an independent film producer and writer here in the Bay Area. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, and the email again, forum@kqed.org. Chi-Wei Yang, there are so many festivals, as we said earlier, here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Tell me, do you go to all these festivals, and what do you learn from them?
I do, and I love all the diversity of the different festivals because in a lot of ways we all complement each other. You know, I love going to the SF Indie Film Festival because, you know, there's a lot of great independent films there, going to the International for world cinema, and then to Frameline Gay and Lesbian and lots of others. And so I think what we take away is that, you know, the world of indie filmmaking is really expansive and really changing, very dynamic. It's very reactive. And in a lot of ways, it's interesting for us to look at and see where Asian American films fit within that larger landscape. And in a lot of ways, I think American independent filmmaking is changing so quickly. And I honestly do think that films like Jennifer's and HP's are leading that way, are redefining it. You know,
how so?
Well, in a lot of ways, if we look at a film like Jennifer's, which is in a lot of ways a highly experimental narrative film, and it combines live action with animation, you know, has this a very racially ambiguous family that's all mixed race in a post-apocalyptic future, you know, but it's still dealing with ideas of family, you know, and I think that those types of perspectives have not really been seen at a film festival like Sundance or other places. And with HP's films too, I mean, you know, sure, we have big blockbuster musicals like Chicago and we have High School Musical, but I think that Colma and Fruit Fly are better than all those by far. And you're welcome. They are. And really, it's I don't think we need to look to Hollywood to redefine these genres, but to independent filmmakers like HP, who's, you know, working with a musical genre, but, you know, working from a gay perspective, from an Asian perspective, and offering a different take on that.
Hmm. One of the people coming to speak at the festival this year is Ang Lee, who's going to be discussing, I guess, a film from 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why did you have him come, and why? What's the purpose of what are you hoping to have him bring to the festival?
Well, Ang is such an important person. You know, we had him early on at the film festival. He's in the 90s as he started to really develop as a filmmaker. And I think he's such an interesting filmmaker because he's able to really work in many different ways. He's working in Asia. He's making films like Crouching Tiger, Lost Caution. And he's making very quintessentially American films. His latest film is about Woodstock. And in a lot of ways, I think a lot of filmmakers aspire to be like him, to be that flexible and have that much range. And he is going to be speaking about Lost Caution, and this is something we're presenting in collaboration with UC Berkeley. But it's also a film for him that's quite personal, but also very controversial too, in his relationship with Taiwan and China. So we really wanted him to tease out some of those ideas about a personal project that still does present some obstacles because of his relationship with his homeland.
What do you folks, HP and Jennifer, do you get a chance to interact with filmmakers as they come through? And what do you learn from them, the ones who've, quote unquote, made it?
Made it? I don't really know what made it means.
Well, that's mostly why I had it. Listeners couldn't see it, but I had quotation marks around
the bunny ears. Yeah, I've met a few filmmakers who I really respect, and I just kind of assume they've made it because I see their films on the big screen and I'm thinking, this is a brilliant, brilliant film. My jaw's on the floor. I feel humbled for being at the same festival. And then 3 years later, they don't have distribution still, you know? And I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm speaking specifically of Even the Fire Horse, which is one of my favorites from 2006. So Julia Kwan, Chinese-Canadian film. Where is that? And then when you talk about the ones who've really made it, this, you know, more populist thought will tell you, okay, we're automatically talking about Justin Lin, you know, Finishing the Game, Fast and the Furious, you know. But now, notice no one says Justin Lin anymore, that is. No one says Justin Lin of Better Luck Tomorrow. Maybe we might, but for the most part, people love saying Justin Lin of Fast and the Furious. When I met Justin Lin, I don't think I met Justin Lin of Fast and the Furious. I met Justin Lin, the Asian American director who came out with Better Luck Tomorrow.
Hmm. Jennifer, tell us a little bit about your film. It has animation in it, as Chi-Wei Yang was mentioning. It's shot in the Bay Area, and also there are themes within that of sort of loneliness and finding one's roots, finding one's tribe. Where does a sense of, you know, where does one belong? What were you trying to say with your film?
Well, Half-Life's about a young boy and his teenage sister, and they're trying to win their mom back from a manipulative trophy boyfriend. And I think that I wanted to explore alienation and distance between family members, as well as our own alienation from, or our sense of disregard of the world at large. And what you'll see in the film is that it's a bit of the way that the family disintegrates is pacing a kind of global disintegration. And I think the idea for me was that I wanted people to take a look at what our priority, where our priorities are. You know, while, you know, global warming is accelerating, why are we ignoring our children? Why are we trying? And each of the characters within Half-Life are escaping each other in different ways. Some of them are turning to relationships that aren't going to work. Some of them are turning to fantasy worlds, like the boys jumping into an animated alternate reality. So it's about escapism. It's about alienation. It's about also not necessarily fitting in one specific identity. That is, the gay male character played by Leo Nam is toying around with his sexuality in a kind of careless way and inflicting it on both his boyfriend and his best friend. And the family who lives, who is a Hapa family, who's living in a primarily white community in Walnut Creek, California, Lafayette, California, they're never outwardly treated as outsiders, but there's this undercurrent of racism that kind of permeates through their neighborhood barbecue, for example. Mm.
I wonder if Chuyang or Corey, do you ever hear from more, you know, for lack of a better word, conservative elements of the community that say, you know, you're presenting aspects of our community in ways that are not positive?
Yeah, there's a lot of dissent or some critics who comment on, oh, too much gay stuff. Or I remember in the 90s, I was actually received some death threats because we screened some films relating to AIDS and HIV. Very surprising, but people have reactions. I wanted to also add something to what Chiwe had mentioned about about not looking to Hollywood to redefine. I think and really believe, and I think many of us do from the independent film community, that the independent filmmakers and media makers are really the ones who lead. And Hollywood actually looks at the fringe communities or fringe makers for that guidance, because I think the independents are the ones who are more resourceful and who struggle with fewer resources. But I think a lot more creative freedom, and I think that's where the brilliant ideas and genres and characters and stories that really reflect what's going on the street get noticed by Hollywood, and then Hollywood tries to perfect it and refine it with, you know, by throwing big sums of money at it. And sometimes it works, and sometimes they're brilliant results, and other times I think the independent media landscape is really prolific in creating new stuff and new ways of telling stories.
Can you think of a film that maybe made a debut at this festival that has had an impact in some kind of a more, you know, general way in the industry or on a filmmaker?
You know, I mean, one film that I'll mention is we opened the festival in 2003 with Bend It Like Beckham, which is a wonderful British Indian film. And, you know, you look at the success of a film like Slumdog Millionaire, which, you know, I think is very curious and offers a lot of interesting, thought-provoking. But we looked at the success of Bend It Like Beckham, which we screened, went on to make, you know, quite a bit of money at the box office. And I think that really paved the way for both a studio to say, okay, we're going to distribute more Indian films, and for audiences to say, oh, I can relate to this young soccer player, this girl. Maybe I can relate to other Indians too.
Mm. Why did you say, what was curious about Slumdog? It's success, or?
It's success. I mean, I think that it's a very good film. But I think what it also does is it really taps into a lot of other undercurrents happening today. This idea of change, of youth, of engagement, of people of color. You know, I think these are things that are on people's minds and that didn't go unnoticed with the Academy.
Yeah. We would love to hear from you, 866-733-6786. Maybe tell us about a film or a film festival that you've been to. It doesn't have to be necessarily the Asian American Film Festival. One that, for a film that you saw, really stuck with you or got you thinking or got you more interested in the genre that you went to see. Or what do you think of film festivals in general? Are they too segregating of ethnic, racial, quote-unquote, minority films? We'd love to hear your thoughts about that and anything else on your mind. 866-733-6786. 1786. We've got an email here with someone asking, what are some films in the past festivals that you really enjoyed but became forgotten? Chi Wei Young?
What are some that became forgotten? Well, I think that one that HP mentioned earlier is called Even the Fire Horse. It's a very nice Chinese-Canadian film that dealt with religion and a coming of age. It went to the Sundance Film Festival, went to a lot of places, but really
it
won at Sundance and then really disappeared. I think that was a really fantastic film. There's another film called Punching at the Sun, which I think, you know, one really defining, and there's lots of defining moments in Asian American cinema, but certainly 9/11 was one that, you know, changed the landscape for a lot of people. But for a long time, a lot of Asian American films have dealt with ideas of assimilation, of migration, of citizenship, of nationality. And with those events, those ideas changed completely. And a lot of filmmakers were forced to rethink how they're approaching those ideas. And they were no longer ideas of just generational conflict or how we're dealing with our own identities, but in a much broader sense. And Punching at the Sun is a really beautifully subtle film about a young South Asian kid growing up in the Bronx whose brother is shot and is really trying to navigate being brown in New York City after 9/11. It's not dealing overtly with politics, but it is embedded within it. It's a fantastic film that I think far too few people have seen.
HP, any films come to mind that you think should get a broader viewing than they've had?
Well, I'm going to recap. Even the Fire Horse is definitely my number one that I think should be seen. But I want to touch on Punching at the Sun. Punching at the Sun is a great film, and it won multiple awards at several festivals. It does have distribution, but it's online. And I think it's hard for us to know if that's successful yet. I think it's too new. I think it's great. I think people say, oh, well, that's too bad. It should have had a theatrical release. But, you know, it's true. What Chi Wei was saying is true. A lot more people will see it now. And I think there's this misconception that the computer is going to destroy our lives, that the internet is hell. You know, the truth is, you know, and a bunch of people can download an album illegally, you know, and listen to, let's say, the Rolling Stones. I don't know why I picked them. Let's say they picked an album that they downloaded illegally online. When they come around, when they come to town, are those people going to say, I'm not going to go and see them. I already have the CD and I downloaded it illegally. No, they still go because they go for the social aspect. So if Chi Wei ever plans to have a retrospective and play Punching at the Sun again, I'm sure those people who saw Punching at the Sun online will probably say, hey, guys, let's go check this out. It's playing over the festival.
Hmm. This year you opened the festival with a Korean-American film, mm-hmm. right? And I believe— Korean film, rather.
Yeah.
And is the closing film also—
Is a Korean-American
film. Korean-American film.
Yeah.
What was the thought in that? Or is it just— tell me what you were thinking when you decided to do that.
Sure. Well, we really wanted to show off the spectrum of where Korean cinema is going. You know, for the past 10 years, the Korean film industry has been very dynamic. Korea is one of the few countries in the world where the domestic films actually do better than Hollywood films, which is highly unusual. And the film which screened last night, My Dear Enemy, is a beautiful example. I think the best Korean film to come out this year. And on the other hand, our closing night film is called Treeless Mountain. It's made by a Korean-American filmmaker named So Young Kim. It's shot all in Korea. It's financed by U.S. money and Korean money. So it has a sort of transnational quality to it. And together, I think they give a spectrum for what's happening. And in a way, it underlines another theme that's happening with American independent film, where a lot of filmmakers are looking abroad. They get money from overseas. They find actors from overseas. Or they're shooting overseas in different languages, but they're still American independent films. And another way in which, you know, Asian American films are forcing American indies to become multilingual, multicultural, you know, and to be set in places other than just the United States.
Hmm. What are some other countries that are really, you mentioned South Korea, that where there's really a dynamic? I mean, of course, we know about India, but other countries that may surprise us that there's a really dynamic film industry homegrown. Are there any? Taiwan, of course, but
Taiwan, I think, is a really great example. I think the Philippines, Thailand, and many of these countries, especially let's say in Asia, are creating co-productions now, and they are combining resources in order to have multiple distribution platforms and sources of financing. Sometimes creative teams that are putting new projects together. And I've witnessed that a lot over the last 10 years. There might be a Thai, Japanese, and Korean co-production, for example, or a U.S., Hong Kong co-production, a Vietnamese production that might get some support from Thailand or and so forth. And I think both the creative and the financial elements overlapping and being put together in a project is also a reflection of the way that audiences and makers look at the world and how they're able to go between borders, both story-wise, and I think that's also just reflective of the way people move through the world now.
Chi Wei Yang was talking about Slumdog Millionaire. Do you have any sense of how the success of a film like that could open doors in the way that Crouching Tiger did?
Yeah, I think it has tremendous opportunity. I think over the years we've seen, let's say, films. Well, this is the first film that has reached the kind of, let's say, visible status, awards, you know, super mainstream visibility. Slumdog Millionaire, I'm talking about. But prior to that, there were a lot of other films, let's say, from South Asia, Indian films, other countries that have also had some visibility but have never reached the kind of status that Slumdog has. And I think over the years we've found films like Crash, films like Brokeback Mountain, films like just a whole slew of Babel that are really where their genres have been, let's say if you call it a genre, have had some exposure through, let's say, film festivals in the U.S. and other parts of the world. But so they are not necessarily the groundbreaking films, but I think many of these films will allow a next generation of multilingual films, multi-ethnic casts, and so forth. Hmm. So I think there's every generation or every year even, I think it helps to provide one step of the ladder of expanding the diversity creatively and financially.
HP, do you think that when a film comes out that is commercially successful, that portrays some aspect of the Asian experience, do you think that does the Asian American film community, is it particularly tough on those films?
Oh yeah, of course. You know, I mean, there's like Better Luck Tomorrow has so much backlash, and I'm going to stand behind it and say I do think it's it is a revolutionary film. You know, and I think everything since then has been evolutionary. Then you have things like Harold and Kumar, which isn't necessarily an Asian American film, but it has two Asian Americans in it. And again, it's a great step toward having more a proper Asian American representation on screen. But you do hear a lot of, yeah, but you know, it's basically just Dude, Where's My Car with Asians. You know, it's like, well, what else are you going to say? I mean, it's like saying, oh, yeah, that's like a movie with Asians. I mean, it's still the right step. Yeah. I think a lot of times, I mean, I get a lot of flack from people who say, when Colma came out, for example, I was called a bad role model. I was called potty mouth, filthy, any pejorative term for gay. You know, I think once an Asian American film hits the big screen, all of these Asian Americans project all of their own insecurities and neuroses on it, and they just have to have these expectations saying, but that's not me. And they just have these complaints, and it's going to be a while. We're taking baby steps, and I think for these baby steps, these are pretty big baby steps we're taking.
What do you mean?
As far as Asian American progression goes, or progressive filmmaking goes, and getting our faces seen. You know, maybe it wasn't that great when we had Long Duck Dong up on the screen, but that was kind of a step because at least we needed to have that face up there to know that it was wrong. Now we have John Cho as Sulu. You know, we used to make the joke, say, yeah, if we ever get cast in a movie, we're probably going to play Sulu in a remake. But, you know, it's up there, and everyone loves John Cho and J.J. Abrams, yeah, and everyone loves him. There's going to be something better after that. Maybe the next Star Trek remake will have an Asian American playing James T. Kirk.
Yeah. Chi Wei Yang, what are your thoughts about that? Do you feel like there has been a lot of progress, or is it still, you know, there's still so few portrayals of Asian Americans on television, for sure? Mm-hmm.
It is getting better. I mean, there are actually, you know, if we look at the films like Lost, like ER, like Heroes, I mean, there are more roles there, which I think is fantastic because most people, you know, watch a lot more television than they do films. What's interesting is that in a lot of ways, what I like about a lot of filmmakers like Jennifer and HP is that they're not necessarily reacting to Hollywood. I think that's not the best approach to be responding to something. It's really they have a vision, they have an idea, and they're being proactive in creating a world in which they want to see. You know, and that's the most exciting thing. It's like Asian American cinema is primarily an independent cinema. There's not a lot of commercial stuff. You know, there's stuff like Harold and Kumar or Tokyo Drift. But the goal, you know, and I think you know, if you look at, like, say, African-American cinema or Latino cinema, there's a more healthy balance between the commercial stuff and the indie stuff. And I think that's a balance that you want to be able to find. Right now, it's a bit more imbalanced toward independent cinema in the Asian-American world. You know, and we're moving toward that, but that's not the same time. That's not the same as saying that we just want to create commercial films, too. You know, that anyone can do that. But we want to, if we do want to create commercial films, they want to be more, you know, socially conscious ones too.
Here's an email from a listener. She writes, or he writes, can having your film show at a particular festival with a specific identity potentially harm its chances at wider distribution by pigeonholing the film or filmmaker as specific to that identity? What are your thoughts about that, Corey? Corey Tong?
Oh, we had another whole day of talking here. We might be able to cover that subject. But the short response is, I think that there are different audiences that get different things from every festival screening. Some people go into a festival to find industry contacts, some for distribution, some for audience development, some to promote their short film in order to make their next one. I think some people come in for the press. There's so many reasons. And I think the really short answer is just know what the audience or what one really wants to get out of a particular festival and try and understand the audience and the way that the film festival is programmed and really try and make some sensible choices about which festivals you want to screen at.
Chi-Wei Young, anything to add to that? Is there a downside to being in a festival like this?
I think certainly there is. And I think that what's actually interesting, I'd love to hear actually HP and Jennifer talk about this too, because both of them have played at mainstream festivals and also played a lot of Asian festivals and gay festivals. So they've really done that circuit and they've seen it from lots of different sides. The one thing that I will say is that for a lot of independent films, festivals are the de facto distribution circuit. That's it. You know, most films are not going to get theatrical release. And so in a way, you really need to be able to take advantage of how to, if you make a good film and it gets into 10 festivals around the country, you have national distribution, you know, in some ways.
Yeah.
And that's something that it's hard to turn down.
Yeah. Jennifer Pong, what do you hope to get out of this festival?
Well, we're really lucky that we finally came to this festival because we had to do the mainstream American indie tour first for the very reason that your listener was talking about was to make sure that we weren't pigeonholed as an Asian American film, and so we did actually end up hitting up the mainstream films, and as an Asian American film within kind of a mainstream independent festival, I didn't necessarily think that it hurt. I think it helped. I think, you know, when a film like ours plays in Austin, people in Austin are going to wonder what a story about Northern California Asian American is going to be about, and so I think it attracts people, especially because we also were transcending, you know, narrative language by playing with animation as well. So sometimes it helps and sometimes it hurts. And actually, I think when a filmmaker is looking at a film making a film that will eventually play in festivals, sometimes they'll actually decide that they're going to want to make it racially specific because it's a strategic thing, because they know that film festivals are looking to program in a diverse way, so they'll probably prioritize a family story about a South Asian family over a kind of an equal or lesser story about a Midwestern family.
Yeah. You are a woman director, and there aren't a lot of women directors in Hollywood, and I imagine there are even fewer among Asian filmmakers. What are the challenges? What are the opportunities? What are the frustrations you have as a woman being a director in this industry?
It's a fascinating thing, being a female filmmaker. I mean, I don't even know why I chose to do it other than I didn't think that it was going to be a limitation at all. I think some of the challenges, you know, I think of myself as a bit of a feminist in the sense that I really care very deeply about women's issues and how women, I wish that women would stop defining themselves by how men look at them or even other women look at them. And so when I have to cast women and judge their appearance and decide how they will or will not fit a role depending on issues of, you know, beauty issues or whatever, there's a bit of hypocrisy that you have to face in yourself. You have to be both a businesswoman and a woman, and as a woman, you're also struggling with, okay, when will you or will you not have children if you're an independent filmmaker and you're trying to compete with men. There are a lot of issues that come up when women filmmakers talk to each other. Yeah.
Corey Tong, am I right? There are very few female directors in the Asian American film world.
There are probably more than there were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I think many times people, role models are, you know, but we can never overuse that term, because I think another thing that festivals really provide are role models for younger people or who come to the festival and realize, wow, there's a woman filmmaker, there's a gay filmmaker out there, and they're Asian American filmmakers, and they're Hapa filmmakers, and they're getting their stories up on the screen. And so I think every year, practically, there are probably young people, or not just young people, anyone who comes to the festivals, and they will see things that they might be very surprised. And then when they have a chance to meet the filmmaker afterwards, they might be doubly surprised that of who made this story and where they're from and how the film was made. So I think every generation there is going to be a lot of looking and inspiration, role models. That so that's a very intangible part of film festivals.
Chi-Wei Yang, we're short on time, but give us the pitch why folks should go to the film festival next week or so.
Well, you know, there's 108 films screening. These are some of the best new films out there, you know, bar none. There are many of them, all of them are categorized to some degree as Asian American, but I would say to people that this is just good cinema and come out and see it. And, these are films which range from a beautiful Indian film called Heaven on Earth by the Indian-Canadian director Deepa Mehta, all the way to tonight we have a wonderful Korean action kind of gangster film called for Friday the 13th called The Chaser.
All right. And all of these films are online. If you want to learn more about them, what's the...
AsianAmericanMedia.org.
There you go. Chi-Wei Yang, director of the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. Thanks to you. Thanks also to Corey Tong, independent film producer and writer, as well as directors H.P. Mendoza and Jennifer Pong. Thanks to all of you, and good luck with your films.
Thank you.
And Forum's senior producer is Dan Zoll. Our also producer is Kevin Guillory. And at the controls today is Howard Gelman. I'm Scott Schaefer. And today for Dave Iverson, Michael Krasny returns on Monday. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.